Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for all coming this afternoon. I did wonder for a moment whether we were going to be told where the fire exits were, but I think we're all sort of clear as to how to get the hell out. I'm going to talk to you today about, obviously, a subject that I've been looking at for a very long time. I'm going to look at it from a deeply historical perspective. And what I want to try and do is to look at, you know, what are the underlying motors of change or instability or problems that affect the modern Iranian state. So what I'll be looking at on one level will be some of the structural impediments to development. You will see in the slides, and I hope you can see the slides, I'm not sure how visible they are in this light, that there will be several images, and there is one slide, I'm sorry to say, which is a slide full of text, which might be quite dull for you, but it's an essential aid memoir for me, which is why I've got it there. So don't be disheartened if you see a chunk of text coming up. That will come later, because I want to go through a number of points and to try and highlight and explain why I see the current state, the current Islamic Republic in Iran, is in a period of really quite dangerous decline. And the only way really we can understand this is really to look at it from a, as I said, from a historical perspective, and not to just expect to sort of, it's not what you see on the surface that matters, it's what we can try and analyze beneath the surface. It's the longer term trends that really matter. So history for us, history and context, I think, are vital. We are here at a history festival, so I'm going to trumpet, obviously, the value of the discipline above all else. I think history is the queen of the humanities. They say physics is the king of the sciences, but I shan't quibble about that. They can have it if they wish. But history is the queen of the humanities, and why is it so? I think there are two salient, important facts about the utility of history as a means of study. One is that it allows us to study processes over longer periods. We're not just witnessing, as you said, what you see on the surface. You're looking at processes over a timeline. And you can study change. And studying change, I think, is vitally important for all of us. The other thing is that it teaches us how to value evidence and how to study evidence and how to construct narratives, if you will, of periods of history that obviously we can never visit. And actually, being able to study areas that you can never visit is extremely useful for countries like Iran, which many of us cannot visit, and which, as an authoritarian state, can often try and disguise and obfuscate in terms of its data or its evidence that it provides. So I think as a historian, you're particularly qualified and particularly sort of able to look at these facts, to look at these details. This slide actually shows us one of the first embassies that was sent by Britain to Iran in 1809. And it outlines, actually, there's a nice vignette. A vignette, it's actually an encounter that happened a bit earlier than this, actually, in 1800, when the East India Company sent a delegation. But in this earlier period, there were a number of British travelers to Iran, and they observed very closely what the problems of the Iranian state were. And you might think, if you're looking at the 1800s, that this is somewhat detached from our present-day situation. But on the other hand, there's a rawness to the encounter in this period that makes it quite important for us when we're looking at the current predicament. And they have an encounter with the king, and the king says to the British interlocutors, he says, "When I look at the state of your king, he seems to be little more than the first magistrate. He can't do much, and he seems to be subject to the laws of your country." And the British ambassadors say, "Yes, that's absolutely right. Our king, George III, as it happens to be, is the first magistrate. He is limited by laws." And the Persian king says, "Well, that all sounds very interesting, but it's not much fun. I can have a lot of fun. Your king can't have any fun. I can do what I want." And the consequence of this very interesting anecdote, which seems very trivial on the surface, but actually is quite loaded and meaningful if you dig down a bit deeper, is simply this. That the British, when they comment on this, they say, "Yes, you do have an enormous amount of room for maneuver, if you will, in politics. But there's a difference. We might be boring, but we're stable. You might be very exciting, but you're very unstable. And if you want to progress and if you want to develop, you're going to have to find ways in which to stabilize your politics. That your politics can, and your economy, your political economy, if you will, can develop on a stable footing. And the British, who observed Iran at the time, were very, very, actually, to be honest, quite modest, really, about their own achievement. They didn't have to be post-1815, but they were. And they said, you know, we, 150 years ago, were in a state of chaos. We even killed our own king. But now we have adapted. We've learned from our mistakes, and we've moved forward. How else do you think that a small island on the northwestern coast of Europe can come to dominate other aspects of the world? And of course, this always puzzled the Iranians. They were always concerned about what on earth the British were doing in India, for instance. But the British said, well, we applied three tools. Education. I'm not going to say education, 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 by the way, just in case you're worried it's not going to happen. Education, order or discipline, if you'd like, an order or discipline that is guaranteed by the rule of law. And I want to emphasize that concept of the rule of law, because all societies operate on systems of law, customary or otherwise. But what the British were emphasizing was is there's a rule of law to which everyone is subject. And I think that's an important distinction. And the Iranians throughout the 19th century began to absorb many of these ideas. They sent travelers to the West, to Britain in particular, and they studied carefully what was going on. There's an extraordinary experience of intercultural relations between Britain and the wider West, but Britain in particular and Iran during the 19th century, much of which has not been touched, to be honest, but I hope at a later date to produce something for your reading delight, but at the moment that's a bit way off. But nonetheless, they absorbed a lot of these aspects. They were really taken by it. They were interested in ideas of liberty, and they were interested in ideas of development and progressive development. They were fascinated by ideas of industry. Whenever Iranians went to Britain and other European countries, they didn't go to see armies and navies. What they went to see were the naval shipyards. What they went to see were the railroads. What they went to see, interestingly enough, at one stage, was the Thames Tunnel. Now, can you believe it? You know, someone coming from Iran in 1835, where they don't have any extensive bridges or transport network, going to see something like the Thames Tunnel. It was a stunning achievement, and they wanted to know what the secret of that was. And many of them absorbed these ideas, such that by, if I've got this in the right order, by the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, Iran has its first political revolution of significance. The Constitutional Revolution, which was borrowed and emulated in many ways many of the aspects of the British political system. It was, in many ways, in 1906, the apogee of British influence in Iran, to be followed, as you might be expected, by the nadir of British fortunes in Iran, as the British Foreign Office dropped the ball very badly in the following year, but we won't go there at the moment. There were many mistakes made, it has to be said, by Western powers, but all I want to focus on in this talk is the domestic development. I don't want to spend time discussing about, you know, how foreign powers may or may not have hindered or hurt things in Iran. That certainly did happen, but that's part of general international politics. What for me was very striking, what for me is very important, to see how the Iranians tried to deal with these matters themselves, how they tried to deal with the challenge of modernity. And in 1906, you get probably one of the most extraordinary political developments in the country, which sees 14,000 people, I was going to say menfolk, to be honest, because it was all men, 14,000 men out of a population of probably 250,000 in Tehran, seeking sanctuary, believe it or not, in the British Embassy compound in Golhak. And that's the picture that you can see there. They seek sanctuary in the embassy in the summer of 1906. The chargé d'affaires, who's there at the time, is a little bit flummoxed by what he's dealing with, but he sort of handles it reasonably well. And Britain, in a very real sense, therefore, becomes the handmaiden to the Constitutional Revolution and to the emergence of Iran into what we might term the modern age. And the Constitutional Revolution brings with it, as its name suggests, the constitution, a parliament, the division of powers, and ostensibly the idea of the rule of law. But the 20th century that we witness sees lots of ups and downs in this process. First of all, Iranian intellectuals are incredibly ambitious about what they think they can achieve. And we see this repeated over and over again. By the way, when I get to the more contemporary period, you'll see this again, that they have wonderful ideas, very sexy ideas about what they think they can do. What they don't have a good handle on is how they're going to get to these places. So the Constitutional Revolution is full, there's a surplus of ideas. There's a little less on how you're going to actually implement these ideas. So for many years, you see the Constitutional Revolution stall. It eventually basically comes to an end by the period of the Great War, and in its aftermath, there is the constitutional system itself, although powerful in men's imaginations, basically comes to a stuttering halt. And what you see instead is the rise of a new leadership under the Pahlavi dynasty, Reza Shah and his son Mohammad Reza Shah. And I'm going to go through these two individuals very, very quickly just to highlight the points that I want to make. Reza Shah, the first of these kings, is a product in many ways of this constitutional period. He's not great on democracy, he's not great on votes, but he does understand the need to build a state and to construct a state, and he has a lot of very competent people around him. And he also understands that the way to reform the state and to develop Iran's potential is to develop both politically and economically. So these things operate in tandem together. Okay? If you want to develop your economy, you have to do it within a political framework. His son, on the other hand, who reigns from 1941 to 79, with that brief interlude, which I'm sure will come up in questions of the Mossad, their coup, and others, in between, but nonetheless, for that period from 1941 to 79, he decides to really follow a path of development that's economic rather than political. He doesn't want to deal with politics. He doesn't want to deal with the process of democratization. He's not particularly interested in the rule of law. What he sees, and he borrows very heavily from an American model of development, which is simply that what you do is you develop the economy and everything will come from it. It's the origins of the triumph of the metric and the economist over everything else. And I think it's a complete and utter disaster. Why? Because what they do is they see facts and figures and they don't see the moral compass or the moral umbrella that's meant to surround it. And what I mean by that is you've got to build the political and legal framework in which that economic growth can happen without it lapsing into corruption, which is exactly what happens in the 1970s. Iran becomes extremely wealthy in the 1970s. Some of you will have worked in Iran in the 1970s. The oil price rise is dramatic. Iran is in a boom period. It's looking fantastic. It's the Japan of the Middle East. But it's faced by rampant corruption and massive liquidity. And one of these issues of rampant corruption, a lack of political development, a lack of democratization ultimately yields to an Islamic Republic and an Islamic Revolution in 1979. And this Islamic Revolution that we see in this Islamic Republic we see today is the heir of this period. And what I want you to sort of see and what I want you to hopefully try and appreciate is that it's the product of a period of development that stretches back nearly 200 years. All revolutions like to think that they have sort of turned the dial to zero and we're starting afresh, but it's simply not true. The Islamic Revolution at the end of the day inherited a state. It inherited an incomplete state. It inherited a deeply flawed state, but it inherited one. It inherited a very powerful military, which it was very grateful for when the Iraqis invaded in 1980. Okay, so it's not that it inherited nothing. It inherited a great deal, and it tried to shape it to its own interests. But how did it try to deal with these things? And this, I think, comes to the crux of our problem. When it looked back to the previous period of development, how did it want to do this? First of all, it eschewed any sort of idea of dealing with the West. Okay, the West is just not a reliable partner. They did argue ideologically that it's neither East nor West, but frankly, you know, if you're going to call your previous greatest ally the great Satan, you know you're not going to get on with them for much longer. You, the Brits, become the little Satan, by the way, but don't worry about it. You often take the top title, much to the American irritation or frustration. But if you're going to do that, obviously, it means you're not going to have very productive political or economic relations with that power, and so you're going to try and look to the wider world or even to the East. But what do you try and do? Do you try and reform the state under a particular understanding of modernization, democratization, if you will, that begins to see that the failures of the Pahlavi state, the failures of the Pahlavi state were dictated by the fact that they did not actually develop their politics to frame their economics, or are they going to repeat the mistakes of the past? And what I'm going to suggest to you is that when you look at what happens in the Islamic Republic, what they do is they inherit this state. They inherit this state, which is quite wealthy, and they become complacent about it. They know the cost of everything and the value of nothing, basically. And they spend, spend, spend. They blame a lot on the Shah, a lot of which is not necessarily the case, but nonetheless, it's an easy one to blame. You always blame your predecessor for things that go wrong. But at the same time, what they tended to do was to take all his vices and leave all his virtues. So what you find in the Islamic Republic is an attempt, basically, to develop the state along a certain direction, deeply ideological, deeply religious, which tends, at the end of the day, to accentuate the worst in that political development. One of the arguments they used to have is they said, we need to bring religion back into politics. The Islamic Revolution is the most effective postmodern state in the world. And I joked about this with someone that I don't know if it was the postmodern state or a pre-modern state. Because what they basically did in bringing religion back into politics is they made religion political. And they criticized that themselves. They recognized that themselves. They said, what we've done is instead of bringing ethics into politics, we've brought corruption into religion. And there have been periods in the last 40 years where they have tried to make changes. Not that they don't know what's going on. This is the rather heavy text-based slide, so don't pay too much attention to it if you don't want to. It's fine. It is in the book, however, so you can catch up with it later. But what is it that causes the problems of the Islamic Republic today? And again, do bear with me. It is an abridgment, obviously. I have limited time. I have a bit more time than I thought, but I do have limited time. So I'm going to go through a couple of these to sort of say, you know, why, what I think the problems are. People in Iran understand that if they want to develop the state in a productive and coherent way, they have to do it both politically and economically. You can't do one without the other. But the sad fact is actually that they've found doing political change far too difficult. So they've tried to do it through the economic line only. But even that's failed, because if you do it on the economic line only, you face exactly the same problems the Shah did, which is basically enhanced corruption. And the corruption in Iran, by the way, is breathtakingly good. Okay, they do corruption extremely well. Okay, and they do that because, as I've said in this slide, there is an absence of the rule of law. If you don't have a legal framework for how you're operating, and you don't have a legal framework that rules, that governs you, then corruption is rife. All politics becomes personal. And it's about networks, who you know, whose back you're going to scratch, so on and so forth. Talking to friends I've known who have been in and out of the prison system in Iran, I can tell you that they often see the prison system as a revolving door, where different factions send their rivals into prison, extract a bit of money, send them out again. They go in and out, in and out, in and out. It's not based on any criminality particularly, although one would say the whole system is quite criminal. But it's not based on any particular criminality. It's based on whether you are in or out of favor. When you don't have the rule of law, by the way, and when you don't have an element of transparency, everyone is very anxious to prove deniability. You don't want to take responsibility for anything, just in case, if you do take responsibility for anything, it might get you into trouble. Writer after writer who's commented on Iran always says that the Iranians are the most mendacious people in the world. I think that's a bit unfair. Obviously, I would say that. I think the Russians have a wonderful saying. They say the Iranians are the only people who lie more than we do, which I think is a bit, which is sort of like damning with faint praise, really, and it's not great for the Russians either. But anyway, it's almost like they're sort of proud of it or something, or they're admiring of it. But I've argued in other things that I've written that if you look at this, why is it that people are unwilling to be transparent or blunt or truthful? And they often comment on this. They always say that when Iranians talk to Europeans, but particularly the British or the Americans, and the Americans in particular, they're very blunt. Everyone tells the truth. We know that's not necessarily true, by the way, but nonetheless, that's the way they see it. But if you don't have a rule of law and everything is based on networks and who you know and whether you're close to power or not, or, you know, whether you're feeling, you know, if corruption is rife, the last thing you want to do is to be honest. Because you never know if you're honest whether you're going to get into trouble. So I've always thought that the element of mendacity that exists in Iran society is a sort of Iranian martial art, if I can put it that way. It's the weapon of the weak, you know. Have you been there? Have you done this? Who did that? And you go, well, you know, actually, I don't know. I mean, possibly, maybe. Went this way, went that way. But of course, this does not help if you're a foreign investor coming to Iran saying, I'd like to invest in your industry here, or I'd like to invest in your company. And they go, could we see your books, please, and see what the accounts are like? And they go, accounts? Do you think we'd commit this stuff to paper? Because for the very real reason, you know, one is that you'll obviously get taxed and you don't want to get taxed, do you? But the second thing is you just don't want to be honest about it because people will start asking questions. Where did you get your money? How did you get your money? Why have you got your money? Is it time to spend a bit of time in prison so we can get these details out of you? So the best thing to do is not to talk at all. And this goes to that point about the mercantile mentality. This is probably one of my more, I suppose, deeper points in some ways, but I'll try and summarize what it means. What I want to sort of emphasize here to you is for those of you who have visited Iran, you'll know that you'll find many things familiar. Iran is just as much in love with money as any other country. There's nothing particularly pious about the country. There's nothing particularly Islamic about the country. They pay more interest on bank rates in Iran than they'll pay here. They justify it in different ways, obviously, but they do it. So money and the accumulation of money is very much, you know, at the heart and core of what Iran does. But their approach to money and their approach to the accumulation of money is quite different to what is dominant in Western societies. And I emphasize that point about dominant because it obviously has many different varieties. But this is a mercantile mentality which is founded principally on trade, not on industry. And again, it's that sort of short-term, volatile sort of approach to capital accumulation. And it's different. And I say that it's different because I dealt with numerous Western companies in the 1990s, very eager to get engaged with Iran, particularly in the oil and gas sector, and they never were successful. This was before, by the way, sanctions really began to bite in Iran. So they were never successful. Why were they not successful? Because they were actually talking two different languages. And I realized that when I was there, it was quite striking, really. They'd all talk about the joys of accumulating money, but they did it in completely different ways. So when an oil company said, well, we'd very much like to come and invest in the Iranian oil industry, obviously we have a 20-year vision, and we'd like to invest in the Iranian oil for the next 20 years. The Iranian response normally would be, 20 years? That's a bit long, isn't it? We haven't thought about next year yet. And it is absurd, of course, because the oil industry, among many things, does need a long-term plan. But if you're not able to provide evidence of stability and long-term stability, nobody's going to invest in you. And most Western companies would say to me, we're very happy to invest in Iran when the Iranians invest in Iran. It's quite a good litmus test. So that was also, you know, that was an issue. This is compounded, of course, by revolutionary ideology. Let's not ignore revolutionary ideology, which dominates today, by the way, in a way that's really quite frightening. It's quite millenarian. It's tied very closely to the Russians today, by the way. If you want to understand what the Iranians think about the global order and how dishonest it all is, just talk to the Russians. Medvedev's been quite good at talking points recently. Highly millenarian, the unjustness of the Western global order, the unjustness of the order that was established after 1945. You haven't lived unless you've talked to a German minister who's encountered his Iranian counterpart who sympathized with him on the fact that they got a really raw deal in 1945. And believe you me, the German minister runs a mile and says, well, I don't think we don't quite see it that way. But this idea that the international order is unjust and unjustly weighted against them is something that you find very, very widespread among Russians today, among Iranians, among Venezuelans, among basically all those people who Iran calls the axis of resistance. And it's a deeply held ideology, and it borrows some of the ideas and tropes that we have among dissident opinion in the West, of course. But it magnifies it and puts it on a whole different scale and keeps its country basically hostage to that idea. The mafia economy is, I think, very clear from this idea of a mercantile mentality, networks, lack of rule of law. Basically, if you've got guns and you've got access to resources, you're in a plum position in terms of running the economy. And that's actually something that's become very, very clear even in the current election that we'll see, which I'll use as a case study in a minute. So the Iranian state, over the period of the last 30 years, has failed really to take reform in a serious way. What it's done is it's basically taken its inheritance and it's spent it. I mean, that's basically what it's done. Okay? And there have been periods, and there are a number of people who know exactly what the problem is and demand and ask and request and urge and whatever that things have changed. but I don't think really they've understood the level of the structural impediments and the level of the structural problems that face it. No amount of cosmetic change is going to make a significant difference to the way in which the state is run. And at the moment, the closest similarity, in a way, to the Islamic Republic of Iran is the Soviet Union in the 1980s. It's getting to a stage where reforming a system that has become so corrupt and so stuck in a sort of the ideological rigor mortis that it currently enjoys being the wrong word there, obviously, but, you know, currently gripped by, that if it does decide to change, it faces this real conundrum that change could mean the end of the system. Of course, there are many in Iran who'd be absolutely elated by this idea, but obviously those who are governing the country do not want that. And what we've seen, therefore, is a series of crises that are affecting the country. The state becomes more and more paranoid as it faces these crises, but the crises are mounting. And if we go back to 2009, to the Green Movement that racked the country during the elections of that period, which are now being echoed today, by the way, in the current election cycle, this sort of kicked off a series of protests, slightly interrupted by nuclear negotiations that were held between 2013 and 2015, but only slightly interrupted by that, probably more interrupted by COVID, to be honest. But then with a series of protests that rocked the country between 2017, 2019, and again in 2021, in the Women, Life, Freedom protests. Interestingly enough, the most violently repressed protests were 2019. We estimate that at least 1,500 people were killed in 2019, but they weren't in the main cities. They were mainly outside in the fringes and the margins in the south and the west in rural areas. But in some cases, the repression and the brutality put down the protests was pretty severe. In some cases, we have record of them being machine gunned. And at the time, the Ministry of Interior said, and it's very interesting, it's interesting how ministers can sometimes let the cat out of the bag, but they say, why did you use such violence? Why did you use such violence to repress the protesters? And he said, well, we faced an existential threat. The state could have collapsed. And I thought, well, there's an admission. He basically used that as a justification. Then, of course, 2021, you have... 2022 is what I'm talking about. 2022, the Women, Life, Freedom protests. You have basically another very severe repression, but not as bloody as 2019. What's more interesting about it, though, is that it was in the eye line of most people, because a lot of it occurred in the bigger cities and people paid attention. And because a woman was the focus of the protest and because women's rights were the focus of the protest, it did galvanize opinion in the West. It's very striking when you talk to the protesters in 2022. They used to say, you know, much more men have died, but we're quite happy for it all to be publicized through women because it's the only thing that makes the West pay attention. And he had a point, by the way. He said, far more people died earlier, but nobody paid any attention to us then. But now people are beginning to pay attention. So I think these things all hint at the problems, well, I think stronger than a hint, that the problems that are facing the country. Massive, massive political crisis of authority, a moral crisis, if you will, an economic crisis that is extremely severe. The currency is in the process of, it's sliding very, very heavily, certainly. It's devalued by several 100% over the last few years. There's an ecological crisis, which is frightening, I have to tell you, which hardly anyone mentions. The country is running out of water. Very, very serious, but people aren't paying attention to it. And then, of course, they have their international crisis, because only in Iran, when you're facing all these crises, do you decide that now's the time to double down with Russia and its invasion of Ukraine. So if anything was going to lose any European sympathy, it was going to be that. But I want to go back a little bit to the ecological crisis because it's an important one. The ecological crisis actually tells you exactly what the problem with the country is. A lack of investment, a lack of planning when you do invest, so they build the dams in the wrong places. What happens is that it drains the water out of particular areas that need it, so that in 50%, think about it, 50% of the country is facing a crisis in its water table. The water table has collapsed. Nobody talks about it, actually. I mean, there are a few activists who do, but quite a few people don't, because they all think, as with a lot of the environmental problems, that it's far too distant. You know, we can't deal with it because that's dealing in 10 or 20 or 30 years' time. And, of course, the vision in Iran is very short-term, of course. We're only dealing with the next day or the next week. So the idea that, you know, we might have a problem in 10 or 20 years' time. But the reason why I always like to use the environmental crisis as a case study is principally because it has nothing to do with the West and it has nothing to do with sanctions. It has to do with mismanagement and corruption and a failure to understand in a very simple way that when you have a population of 90 million and rising, your infrastructural needs are different to when you had a population of 38 million in the 1970s. And yet they've never actually thought that what we need to do is properly update these plans. It's the same with their energy strategy. So all these things, I think, are very serious problems and structural problems in the Iranian state. And I want to say this because, frankly, when we get to the election, we all get very excited about the fact that there's a new election in Iran, and lo and behold, the regime has suddenly allowed a relative moderate to stand. They do joke about how realistic these moderates are because they all seem to be really applying for the same post. But it is interesting because it has shown that the regime has started to shift ever so slightly and in very small measure in a direction of allowing a little bit of flexibility. The person there on your left, that's noted as green, is seen as the moderate and the reformist. He's not a significant player by any stretch of the imagination. He's a sort of a diluted reformist, if you will, but it's fascinating to see how much interest he's garnered among the population that are determined to get some change. The four on the right, as you can see all in red, are all the various mixture of hardline revolutionary zealots, so we won't waste our time about that. The chap in grey is probably the most interesting, because he's also a deeply unpleasant person. He's a cleric. He was involved in the Death Commission in 1988, which oversaw the extrajudicial murder of 4,000 individuals in prison. He admits to it, by the way, but he says it's not my fault. You know, I just did what I was ordered to do. Yet he's probably been the most interesting candidate in this election. I've never seen anyone heap more abuse on his opponents than this man. And I've never seen anyone heap more abuse on the entire Islamic Republic than this man. To the extent that this cleric has said publicly, if only we could get rid of the clerics, this country would be a flourishing democracy. Who the hell says that? I mean, it is surreal. And all of us who've been watching this said, oh my God, the mass murderer is the guy who talks most sense. He obviously hasn't got any chance of getting elected, but he's been very, very vocal, and he's obviously going to get a plum job in whoever wins the election. Now, at the moment, the person who might seem likely, tomorrow is when the first ballot is run, is the chap who's marked as green because he's seen as reformist and he's seen as more moderate. And to some extent, by the way, you will likely get in the press and other places people talking if he does get through, which I suspect he will, actually. There'll be a lot of hullabaloo in the press about, a new dawn in Iran. But again, it's important to read beneath the surface and see what's going on, quite apart from the deep structural problems that affect the country. Your question mark is not whether this man can get elected, it's whether this man can do anything. And I have to say, the prognosis does not look good. It doesn't look good because he himself said in one of his election debates, and I have to say, the election debates in Iran are better than the election debates we've had here. Because, you know, here you have real people who've killed real people, slagging off other people and threatening them with murder. I mean, you can't get better than that. The mullah, who used to be in the sort of Ministry of Intelligence, so that tells you all you need to know, was asked a question by someone on one of these sort of these debates, and he thought the question was very impertinent and threw it back at the questioner. And you could see, I mean, it was actually joy to watch. You could see the fear on the guy's face as he realized that he may have overstepped the mark in asking a member of the Death Commission a particularly nasty question. So what I want to, you know, what people will say is they'll talk about things that are familiar with them. We'll look at this election and we'll think of this election as something that well mirrors out. We have a population that's disaffected, a population that's disillusioned, a population that hates politicians, a population that's bored. You know, all the same problems. And I know I'm going to get someone here or in America or someone say, it's all very familiar, it's the same as us. But it isn't. It really, really isn't. All these candidates have been vetted. There are no political parties in Iran. There were 80 candidates that put themselves forward to become president. Some of them were so incompetent, it was unbelievable. Some of these guys are pretty incompetent too, by the way. There's a vetting body and a guardian council that vets them. Within 3 or 4 days, they decided on these 6. They never have to explain why they decided on these 6. They just decide on them. They then say, this is the raft of candidates you may vote for. They then also say, if you cross the red line, by the way, we can still rule you out of contention, so don't get too carried away with what you're saying. Having said that, we want a good turnout, so, you know, let's raise the tempo a bit. Let's get people excited. Let's get people involved. The primary responsibility of this election is to get a higher turnout, a higher turnout from the previous 3 elections, which hovered at around 40%. Again, you might say 40%, marvellous, but by Iranian standards, that's dreadful. We're likely now to maybe get between 51 and 52%. Still poor, but actually by Iranian standards, they're fine. They'll take it. So they'll get their turnout, they'll get their cosmetic change, they'll get their window dressing. A number of Western journalists will say, you know, marvellous, Iran, reform again. This chap who's going to win is a lovely man. He smiles. He says the right things up to a point. What he also says, and this is interesting in one of the debates, is he says, I'm willing to accept anyone into my election campaign, wait for it, because I want their votes, which I thought was very honest. But I have to tell you that the minute I become, if I become president, I will only operate under the strict guidelines of the Supreme Leader. So that tells you all you need to know. So you've got to basically temper your expectation of what this guy can deliver. But the whole election process, you have to see the election process as an act of performative politics. It's their bread and circuses. And I've got to tell you this, they've done a pretty good job at it. But this ultimately is, as they say, who is the real winner of this election? It's actually the Supreme Leader, who will be able to say, we've generated a bit of interest, we've raised public participation, and I can quite understand why people will want to prevent any of the more radical hardliners getting in. But at the end of the day, nothing fundamental will change. And when they did a poll, I think yesterday, of Iranians, and they said, what do you think will change? Do you think that they will change the veiling laws for women as a result of this? Do you think there'll be a change in the economic direction of the country? Do you think there'll be a change in the international relations of the country? The vast majority, 2/3, say no. We have no expectation whatsoever. Our simple desire is to try and send a signal to those in charge that, you know, we don't like this radical revolutionary element. And I think that on its own is actually quite encouraging. That on its own is not a bad result. If we can convey to people, and if the Iranians can convey to people, that the vast majority of the population, given an opportunity, will not choose the radical revolutionary candidate. I want to give you one statistic to make you think very carefully about the paradox that is modern Iran. The Iranian regime has struggled to get any popular support for the war against Israel in Gaza. Iranians, younger Iranians, look in horror at what's going on university campuses in the West, because they don't understand it. The largest crowd, pro-Palestinian crowd, and it's interesting when you look at it, but it's eminently explainable, by the way, for those of you who want to know. The largest crowd they've been able to pull out, pro-Palestinian crowd in Iran, is 3,000. That tells you in a very, very clear way what the gulf is, the disparity is between state and society in Iran. The state is obviously very pro-Palestinian. It has been supplying, and as we saw recently, the sort of the brouhaha with Israel and the missile strikes and the triumphalism that they tried to put forward, although even that also had some interesting anomalies about it. I remember sitting up and they said the Iranians have launched their missiles, and I thought, oh my God, they've done it, this is it. And then they said the drone at 120 kilometers an hour will take 8 hours to reach its target. And I thought, blimey, it's not really a surprise attack, is it? I mean, it was a very, very odd attack. They were quite lucky, actually, they didn't do more damage. But it was a very, very odd attack. But they had to do something, and they were very quick to get behind the parapets once it was done. And they were lucky there was not more damage done. But more interesting about it, really, is that of the missiles that were launched, and they were the ones that got through, I think 7 of the 112 got through, of the missiles that were launched, not the drones, 50% of them didn't launch at all. Quite a few fell in Baghdad, which isn't helpful. Yeah. So, you know, we've got to ask ourselves, really, quite how effective are they? Their drones, yes, are very good, but they're cheap, cheerful, they're suicide drones. And when Raisi died in his helicopter crash a few weeks later, they needed the Turks to come in with their own drone to find the helicopter because they didn't have sophisticated enough drones to find the helicopter. One of the more bizarre things that occurred out of this, by the way, was that when the Turkish drone went over, and it's, this is the joy of modern technology, by the way. I mean, the sort of research that can be done today on an iPhone is really quite extraordinary. So as this Turkish drone was going forward to survey the land of Azerbaijan to try and find where the Iranian president's helicopter had crashed, it somehow miraculously flew over an Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps missile site, streaming the entire securitizer back to NATO headquarters, as far as I can. So, and what was even more bizarre about it was I was able to see this because Iranian dissident communities were just broadcasting this on Telegram and Instagram and others, saying, oh my God, look at this. The Turks have just flown over a secret site and they've just broadcast the entire film back. None of this, joking aside, breeds a sense of confidence, I want to say, in terms of the way in which the country is run. And it is the extractive state, to be serious for a moment. That cartoon on your left is a classic one. Here's a country that's rich, rich. Fourth largest oil reserves in the world. Second largest natural gas reserves in the world. Still messing around on nuclear energy. In which it has one of the poorest societies in the world. And it's not able to deliver. And people are complaining about it, and rightly so. But the one on the right is also entertaining, because what does the regime try and do when it faces a crisis? What do they say? Is it nationalism or patriotism? I can't remember. Patriotism, nationalism is the first refuge of the scoundrel. Here we have, so when these missiles went off to Israel, a number of Iranian pro-regime sympathizers, whatever, said, ah, Khamenei is the new Cyrus the Great, which I find very entertaining. Given that Cyrus the Great is about as, you know, an un-Islamic leader as the Iranians can find. And they got this statue, if you see on the right, of Cyrus the Great. By the way, just to emphasize, nobody knows what Cyrus the Great looked like, by the way, so this is a wonderful sort of like modern makeup. And then put Khamenei's face, and they say, Khamenei is the new Cyrus. Not really understanding the irony of that statement, of course, because Cyrus liberated the Jews from Babylon in 539 BC. Khamenei was busy trying to pulverize them. So it's not, you know, it's not quite the analogy they want. But nonetheless, it was interesting to see how they try and use nationalism as a means of trying to keep people on board. And I think this ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, will be their undoing. Nationalism is a tiger that I think the Islamic Republic will ride at its peril. There is a popular sentiment in Iran which is moving in a completely different direction. That is the tomb of Cyrus the Great. I thought we'd end on a really quite historical note. So the tomb of Cyrus the Great in Pasargad in Iran, it's 4 hours from the nearest city, Shiraz. If any of you ever manage to go to Iran, by the way, I do urge you to go to this place. It is the most magnificent tomb. It's in a complete sort of stark landscape. And the tomb of Cyrus the Great, I mean, for any of you who have a fascination with Alexander the Great, you know, put it aside. It's not worth it. Go to Cyrus the Great. Much more interesting. Okay, and Cyrus the Great, wonderful tomb. And it has now become a source of pilgrimage for Iranians. Such that they travel there on the Persian New Year in March, but also on what they believe to be his birthday. Okay, I mean, this is completely invented, but nonetheless, his birthday on October 31st. And they go there, and they march, and they praise, and they sing his praises, and they sing chants to basically this idea of Cyrus the Great as the father of the nation. And it's become so pervasive that the Iranian government has banned this from happening. They've restricted it. They don't want people to turn up. I think at the end of the day, what you're seeing and what you'll see in the elections that will take place tomorrow and next week is that there is still in Iran, and I think you saw it in the protests as well, that Iranian society will have a means ultimately of basically overturning the repressive apparatus that sits above it. I hope that from a Western perspective, when this opportunity comes up, we won't be so stupid as to ignore it as we have done in the past, or indeed to hamper it. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, I will stop there because it's 22 seconds. which is not bad for a Persian and an academic to boot. So I think that's... Now, I'm going to try and administer these questions myself as well. I see this gentleman with the black shirt there. But for those of you further back, if you just wave would be better because I probably can't see as much of it. And there's a gentleman there.
Thanks, Ali. Really interesting. So I was at a conversation a month or two ago with Niall Ferguson. And he put forward this idea of, I think he called it the axis of ill will, comprising North Korea, Iran and Russia, and talked about how that was manifesting itself in Gaza and Ukraine in terms of munitions and other things. I just wondered what your perspective on that was in the context of the elections you've just described and the idea of that as a concept, if it's relevant or not, just your perspective on that, really.
Well, I mean, the Iranians have a better term, in a sense, I think. They call it the axis of resistance. I mean, that's what they got. And it's basically Russia, Iran, mainly its proxy allies in the region, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the others. I don't think they necessarily want to go down towards North Korea. Ill will, to my mind, is too soft a term. I mean, I don't think it's ill will. It's not like they just want to be rude to us. So I think it is much stronger than that. What's interesting, I think, about even the commentary that you've seen in the current election cycle, shall we say, is that, you know, it's quite clear that most ordinary people are not interested in this. They're just not interested in it. What they want is to be able to live normal lives. And again, you know, what I was saying, if you look at the Mas Amini protests in 2022, it's very striking. What were they chanting about? They were chanting about very basic rights that had originally been chanted in 1906. I mean, that was, for me, what was most striking. If you look at it and they hark back to 1906, which for them is the origin of this process. Now, of course, as a historian, I'll tell you that that process itself has deeper roots. And the reason why I emphasize those roots is because I do think it's not something new. You know, people tend to alternate and say, I think the regime in Iran is extremely brutal. But I think society in Iran is much more resilient than the state. And that society is what ultimately will win out. And that society is one that says, you know, the axis of ill will. They're not interested. They're just not interested. They find the sort of antagonism even towards Britain. And in actual, I mean, one of the fascinating things I have, and I'm privileged enough to be at St. Andrews with, you know, a varied number of students, some from Iran who've come, you know, relatively recently. But when you look at their attitudes and their talk, it's a sea change in attitude. You know, they have a much better appreciation of the West than we do. But of course they would, because they're not used to it. And they haven't become complacent about it. Okay, they sort of say, I don't know what you're complaining about. We know what we're complaining about. Of course we have. But the point is they say, you haven't seen really how bad it can get. Okay, so I find that, you know, it is interesting. So on the basis of ill will, I'd say that's a bit soft. I don't think it's just ill will. Now, there was a gentleman right in front there, and then I want to go over here if there's anyone here. So I do show, there's a gentleman. Are there any ladies? There's a lady there, so you'll get ahead of the...
I was out in Iran just before COVID, and because I was on an Irish passport, I was
Excellent.
Able to travel wherever I wanted. An awful lot of the Iranians I spoke to had considerable resentment about the Basiji
yeah.
and the extent to which it had a vested interest in perpetuating the regime. Would you like to comment on that?
So the Basiji are the Islamic militia that, you know, at one stage used to be, you know, they used to describe them as Boy Scouts with guns, but it's the guns bit that's important. And they are basically a means by which the regime has sort of recruited in elements of what they might call the dispossessed and others to often get more favorable access to various things and coupons. And they are sort of administered by the Revolutionary Guards as part of the sort of the shock troops for keeping control. I often like to describe the Basij as the sort of the SA, whereas the Revolutionary Guard are the SS type thing. They're two different wings of this sort of type of paramilitary forces. But the Basij, of course, are not all. Many of the Basij are a variety of ages, as we discovered when they sort of assaulted the British Embassy in 2011. In 2011, you know, people said, students have assaulted the British Embassy as if it was somehow legitimate because students had done it. And actually, when you looked at pictures of them, they were very mature students. I mean, it wasn't, you know, and basically they were members of the Basij, you see. I mean, this is what they were. And what I find interesting about what you've said, actually, is it's true that over the last 20 years, certainly I think the last 10 years in particular, there again has been a sea change, really, in attitude to all these different types of units. The Basij have never been popular, but now they're deeply unpopular. And I think that emanates from 2009, where they were used very extensively in the violent suppression of protests in 2009. And they're used regularly again. It's very often the Basij that are out on the streets, not the Revolutionary Guards. But they are directed and commanded in many ways by the Revolutionary Guard. So I think, you know, that's a very real issue for the regime, although I dare say there's probably divisions within the Basij itself. During the Mas Amini demonstrations, for instance, we know for a fact that the regime was very wary of sending local Basij units into their own areas. They always sent them somewhere else because they weren't prepared for the risk of them going towards people they might know. But, I mean, you're quite right to highlight that repressive apparatus. Can I go to the... Was there a lady in the... There we are.
Thank you. You've said that many people just aren't very interested in politics and are just trying to live their own lives and get on with them. I had thought that it's just a waiting game for the population, which is very young, to grow up more, and then everything will change, or is that just a story that's been...
That's one of the joys of economic metrics, you know. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, this is part of modernization thesis, which is the death knell of all proper historical inquiry, I'm sorry to say. But it was basically... So I'll use my own experience of it. So when I first wrote my first book on Iran back in the 1990s, I wrote this long book on the reform movement. And it was a very detailed study of the reform movement. I got very engaged with it. And, you know, one of the hypotheses there was that, there's a youth bulge. And when the youth bulge comes through, and because they've had this population for this year, and younger people are more liberal. Now, the trouble with that is that it's almost like a form of Whiggish history. What it does is it says there's a sort of an inevitability that because young people are basically more liberal, let's just let them get on with it. It's a bit like saying when you get, quote, a middle class, whatever that is, they will become democratic. But none of these things are inevitable. I mean, you know, and what in actual fact they did is they appropriated a lot of these young people and stuck them into the Basij. Yeah? They got a lot of them and they stuck them in, you know. So what they did is they co-opted a lot of people. I don't think people in Iran, by the way, are not interested in politics. I think a lot of them aren't. They're not interested in the particular type of politics of the Islamic Republic. I think given a chance, they're very politically engaged. But what the Islamic Republic has done effectively is to make them politically apathetic because they don't want their interest in politics precisely because it's an attempt to maintain control. But the youth bulge thing, unfortunately, is a bit of a sort of a red herring because I hear it a lot. And the trouble is I've heard it over the last 20 years as if this youth bulge has got stuck at the age of 17 or something. And, you know, obviously people are getting older and it hasn't actually made the difference people think. What I think does make a difference is ideas, actually, more than class, you know, this idea of the search for a middle class. And I'm going to emphasize this because I think there's an important point to be made here. Things like a youth bulge, a middle class, whatever, they're all apparently things that we can measure, right? And statisticians like to get around and they get their IMF figures and their World Bank figures, all drawn from the Islamic Republic, of course, because nothing's really checked properly. And then they say, well, the middle class has grown by this or the population has grown by that. That will mean this. Possibly. But when you're talking about ideas and the impact of ideas, that's a much more difficult thing to measure. And, of course, I talk about ideas. I talk about the impact of ideas and how they can affect that. And the only way you can do that is as a historian, because you can see it over the long period and how things change. And I think that will be the pivotal change. I think that will be the pivotal change, not these metrics. I think they'll all have a sort of an influence, but I don't think any of them are decisive. I'm going to try it. Okay, let me go over this lady here first, and I'll go back to you.
Speaking about Iran, you're dying to talk about Mossadegh.
Yes, I was.
I am too. To what extent, I'll try and keep it short, to what extent was Mossadegh's failure because of us?
Is not entirely, by the way, but yeah, okay.
Well, yes. Kermit had something to do with that.
Yes, that's right.
To what extent is that going to put off modern Iranian youth from trying to do the same thing?
What, democracy, you mean?
Yes.
Well, here's the interesting point for you. So we're much more obsessed with Mossadegh than the Iranians are. Okay, and I'll say that in 2 points. One is that the regime itself is not remotely interested in Mossadegh other than to make us feel guilty. Okay, so they've done it. They did a very good job with the Americans on this, by the way. There is one street named after Mossadegh, and that was named about 3 years ago. Okay, so for the duration of the revolution, nobody in the Islamic Republic could give two hoots about this man. He's a secular Democrat, placed too much faith in the Americans. The real lesson of Mossadegh is don't trust the Americans. Okay, and that's how they use them. Younger people is more interesting, because among younger people, he has been. So when I studied the reform movement, Mossadegh was a very important cultural icon for the reform movement. Younger people really, really promoted him. Now what's interesting, actually, is more younger people look on the constitutional revolution as a much more important signifier of democratic change than Mossadegh. They see Mossadegh as an aspect, interestingly enough, of the Cold War. And they see Mossadegh, and by the way, what I'm talking about here are Iranians in Iran, not Iranians in America or here or whatever. The diaspora is a different animal, okay? So look at Iranians in Iran. What I find fascinating is that Iranians in Iran have moved on from that debate and basically say, yes, things were done that weren't great, but the Islamic Republic can't keep blaming 1953 for what it's doing now. Do you see what I mean? I mean, there's only so much of we had a bad childhood that's going to get past this. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, grow up. And I think that's what's interesting. For me, the great white hope, if I can put it that way, that's probably the wrong way to put it, but the great hope is that, you know, what you have here is in some ways the first element of that triptych that I talked about, education. That what you have is a young, I was going to say to the lady in the back, young, a youthful, let's say, a youthful society that's become, you know, self-educated in a way that's quite impressive. I have a colleague in St. Andrews who's working on school textbooks in Iran. And the school textbooks are classic. And we did a long session on Mossadegh. And, of course, Mossadegh is treated in Iranian school textbooks as the man who trusted America and look what happened. Okay? That's it. I mean, they don't pay much attention to him. Iranians themselves, because of the internet, because of the community, they are educating themselves as to what they think they happen, and I think that's quite important. For me, by the way, if you want British perfidy, and there's ample to pick from, by the way, but if you want British perfidy, 1907 is a much, much worse period than 1953, of which I lay more of the blame on that than the Americans, to be honest. But even then, you know, the Iranians have a role in that themselves, and I think they're also aware that, you know, if we want to have a degree of political maturity, if we want to take responsibility for our own affairs, we have to take responsibility for our own history. Can't constantly blame everyone else for it. And I think that's a very important point. It's one of the points which gives me a little bit of hope. Now, there was a gentleman with the beautiful Panama hat. Is it Panama hat?
Panama, yeah.
Excellent.
So what did the Iranians make of their brothers and sisters across the Persian Gulf in Saudi Arabia? Because a huge amount of change has undergone in the last five or 6 years. How does the government and how do the people view what's going on across the water?
Well, it's a very good point. And actually, first of all, thank you for saying the Persian Gulf, which is a great advance on what we're normally used to. But and it's an important point because, of course, the Iranians do see it as the Persian Gulf, don't they? I mean, they see it as the Persian Gulf, and they look at this, and they say, and it's fascinating, even Zarif, who's much touted as this great, eloquent and loquacious foreign minister who may be back soon, you know, he's very dismissive of the Gulf Arabs. You know, he says, you know, of course, he made a speech once. It was wonderfully condescending in only the way that a Persian could do. He said, of course, you know, we have to understand that the Gulf Arabs are, you know, are worried about us. Of course they would be. I mean, most of their populations would fit in a tower block in Tehran. You know, I mean, if you speak like that, I mean, it's completely absurd, isn't it? I mean, and I said to someone, I said, you know, he wafted on like this, but of course he hasn't helped matters by saying something like that. So I don't think the Iranians are as perturbed by Saudi Arabia as they are by the sheikhdoms in the literal. And I'll tell you why. Saudi Arabia, they sort of see, I mean, they're not, you know, they don't see Saudi Arabia as particularly as a sort of a rival in that. I mean, there's a geopolitical rival, yes. But far more serious, really, is what the Gulf sheikhdoms have done and how they represent in terms of a cultural rivalry. So when Qatar hosted the World Cup, it was a major, major problem. I mean, these are the things that matter. Iranians look at this stuff and they go, why is Qatar hosting the World Cup? I mean, where are we in all this? You know, because they think they should be. And, you know, when you look at the popularity of football in Iran, you know, I mean, it's a perfect contender for hosting events like this. But, of course, they're just completely incapable of doing it. I mean, they just can't do it. And there was a famous incident, quite funny in some ways, where there was a Saudi team. You know, the Saudis are buying in, obviously, all these players. And I think, was it Ronaldo or whatever? I mean, they were one of these teams, and off they were to play a local team in Isfahan. I mean. And, you know, the Iranians were absolutely ecstatic about this because they're going to see Ronaldo, you know. So off they come. And the stadium's full, 100,000 people in the stadium chanting like that. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, for reasons that can only be known to themselves, stuck a bust of Qasem Soleimani at the entrance of the pitch as the teams were walking out, partly, you know, to sort of impress the Saudis. And, of course, the Saudis hated it, promptly switched back on their heels, got on the plane and went back to Riyadh. And this entire stadium was left going, what's the hell's happened to the match? But this is precisely the problem. And it's very interesting because everyone talks about this sort of Saudi-Iran rapprochement. There isn't one. What the Saudis have done is they've hedged their bets, and I think quite cleverly, because they know the Americans aren't necessarily there to going to help them in case things break out hostilities. But there's no love lost between them, and the Saudis have been very, very sort of, ruthless in a sense in the way they've sort of behaved towards the Iranians. And the Iranians have been wholly incompetent. But to my mind, the biggest challenge of the Gulf sheikhdoms to Iran is the fact of their economic success. But it's the Gulf sheikhdoms more than Saudi Arabia because the disparity is so much starker. And I think that's why. I probably have time for one, do I? One or two. Let me just see if there's anyone. Let's go to that gentleman there, yeah. Yeah. And then I'll come back to you.
We haven't mentioned the nuclear situation, I don't think.
No, we haven't.
Can I just first?
I did, it's been passing.
Can I just say thank you? This is a wonderful summary. I've really enjoyed it. Just if we are having this lecture 3 years from now, what will the nuclear status of Iran be?
I think, in my view, the nuclear status of Iran will be actually similar to what it is today. I think the West has already moved on from prevention to containment. So we are in a situation of containment. Iran is at a stage now where it's probably got the infrastructure it needs to build a bomb should it want to do so. I don't think it will take the next step because I think for that it's a red line it's very anxious about. I think because of the problems that I've tried to outline here and the structural problems, the economic problems in particular and how intense it is, that these are things that are going to hold it back. I mean, these are things that are going to worry it. It does not have a supportive population for this. So let's say for the sake of argument, there is an argument, for instance, that people say, in order to create a bit of bombast and a bit of energy and whatever, we're going to detonate, you know, we're going to test a nuclear device and we're going to be a great power. The fascinating thing for me is we're beyond that now in Iran. Nobody is impressed by that. Do you know, when they launched those missiles against Israel, there were public figures that voiced their protestation at it. They were obviously subsequently arrested. But the point that they did that was very striking to me. Israel of all countries, you know, particularly in the current environment, but there were people saying, the fact that we've launched this attack makes me sick. I mean, you know. Now, in terms of the nuclear thing, what people will say, I guarantee you, is why are you wasting your money on this junk instead of building schools, hospitals, you know, increasing welfare, so on and so forth. So that debate, I think, is gone. And that's why I think this nationalism is going to be what breaks them in that sense, in terms of ideas. But I don't think we'll see ourselves much further on. The interesting thing for me is that the Iranians always say, and it, by the way, you'll get this all day, they say, you know, when we're in a bit of difficulty and it's getting a bit tough, let's ramp up enrichment. Because then the Americans, everyone else, will panic and we'll get a nice round of meetings in Vienna. They always want to go to Vienna. I always say to them, don't have your meetings in bloody Vienna. Go to Tajikistan and have your meetings in there, because that will stop them wasting your time. They always, you know, there was a fantastic, you know, when I used to talk to the Americans, I said, the Americans used to complain during the nuclear negotiations. I said, you know, it was a pain for us because we had to travel across the Atlantic every week. You know, they just sort of came across. But the Iranians absolutely, definitely said, they moved from Geneva to Vienna because they said, Geneva's too boring. I mean, but you know, my point is about it, but you're there to negotiate a nuclear agreement. You're not there meant to have fun. I mean, but that's the end of it. So I think in the West, people have cottoned onto this now and have realized that we're not just going to have a meeting for the sake of having a meeting. There was a gentleman here. I'm sorry, I know I've missed a number of you. You've got to stop now. One more, yeah, just this gentleman then. Yeah, it's flashing 000.
Quick one. Where do you see Iran in 10 years' time?
There are several options. There is an option where, you know, there'll be some uplands and basically the democratic movement will win. I think that's probably, it's possible but not probable at this stage. I think that the issue will be is that you'll see a country that is, let's say 10 years, let us be a bit more optimistic. In 10 years' time, they will have managed to change the dial and to move beyond the Islamic Republic. And I say that for 10 years because I do think it's going to be a pretty long, hard struggle, by the way. I mean, I don't see this as a sort of a velvet revolution type thing. So it's going to be a tough haul. And even now, for all the nice-sounding commentary that's coming out in some cases, none of them really understand the depth of the problem they're facing, and none of them really understand or appreciate the depth of the reforms and stuff that you're going and the structural reforms you're going to have to make to the state. So I think it's a tough one. It's going to be a long haul. I always say to people, there is light at the end of the tunnel, but it's a long tunnel. So prepare yourself. And I think I'll end there before I'm completely cut off and the microphone is gone. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.